You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello, you're very welcome. I'm delighted to welcome you, and thank you so many of you for coming. It's a really auspicious start and a good sign that it's the very first live recording of our first podcast in the new series, Technology versus Tradition. And it's really exploring the model for universities of the future. And every time you think you've got a business plan that looks secure and you've got a well-established market and everything's going very well, two terrible words haunt me: Encyclopedia Britannica. They had a perfect model, it was beautiful gold embossing, it was magnificent, it was selling, and then suddenly it stopped. And I think it's really important that we're gathered together. This is also a particular form of Goldsmith's torture, where all of the guests have glasses of wine, but the speakers and performers have glasses of water. This is to incentivize them to get through the proceedings rather more quickly than they might otherwise do, so that they too can have the fruit of the vine. We're very proud in Goldsmiths of a long pioneering tradition of doing interesting stuff, and I'm sure that in the land of MOOCs and open access and of different devices for meeting student needs in the future, we will not be behind the ball. And I'm very proud, Adrian, of working with the University of London, your university. We've been able to establish with the London International Academy one of your four pilot MOOCs and in creative computing. And there are 90,000 enrolments. And I'm sure that number is now already exceeded, but that's an extraordinary uptake, and it does show the power of this form. Now, what that means, you will hear from people who know more than I do, but it's a very, very interesting indicator of a worldwide appetite for a different form of educational experience. And I'm ever so proud that Goldsmiths, working with the university, has played a pivotal part in that. We have a long tradition of innovation. I suppose in research, I think it's true that we were the first, or certainly one of the first, to have practice-based doctorates and performance-based PhDs, are appropriate to this school and to what we do. But it's wonderful to be at the forefront of that kind of innovation and to have set some standards in that field, because believe me, all of those changes were greeted with high degrees of scepticism and disbelief throughout the sector, but now those who were most sceptical are prime competitors. Interesting. And this institution has a long tradition of individuals who broke lots of moulds. I've added one to the list today. I had no idea that Alfred Hitchcock was here in 1415, but he's now on the list of oddities that were at Goldsmiths, followed soon by Graham Sutherland, Anthony Gormley, Sam Taylor Wood, Kitty B. What a list of extraordinary individuals. So a place that kind of believes in innovation. We're getting close to our 110th year, 2014, and we're bound to find ways like this of celebrating and marking that heritage of difference. We are looking very hard at publishing in the future and what a university press might look like in a whole different world. And I'm so excited by the kind of thoughts that are coming through. So I hope that we'll explore some of those areas this evening as well. It feels right that we're pleased to provide this platform, and I'm so pleased that helping sponsor the event and run with us and in the presence of the editor John Gill, the Times Higher is so prominent and so willing. Instantly, there was a very short courtship, Liz. We said, would you be interested? And John said yes.
Yeah. Thanks for asking.
Not only engaging with us, but distantly, but by your presence here tonight. And it is so good to welcome the Vice-Chancellor of the University of London. We are a college that's hugely proud to be part of the University of London. We've had a wonderful, positive relationship over many decades. And Adrian, as a close neighbour leading Queen Mary in the past, and then in the department where he did remarkable work in biz, keeping the flag of research and higher education flying, and now back as Vice-Chancellor of the University, it's very, very good to welcome you here, Adrian. Your own career, pioneering, innovating in the world of statistics and maths teaching, leading best practice in maths teaching over the years, and believe me, the world of mathematical science plays a huge part in defining the future for us and working out those algorithms. Enough from me. John, Adrian, you're so very welcome to Goldsmiths. Thank you for giving the time. What a very good start to our whole series of podcasts. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Pat, for that very warm welcome. I hope we live up to the billing. You said kindly that we know much more about it than you. I'm not sure that's true. I think with this particular area of topic for conversation, it's kind of such a fluid development that everybody's kind of making up as they go along. But there's lots of interesting questions to explore, and we'll hope to do that tonight. Before we sort of kick off with some of the questions and hear from Adrian, we've in the question of tradition versus technology, tradition's won out. We're not mic'd, so I hope you can hear me and can hear Adrian. Yeah, fine. At the back, fine, good. But just to kick things off, Adrian, just broadly, I mean, it's been such an extraordinary, 18 months? I wonder when the term MOOC was coined, for example, probably 18 months ago, I think. And in that time, the university sector has had to really look at a digital revolution that lots of other industries have gone through, certainly journalism, which obviously is something that I'm immersed in and have been for the last 12 years or so. When I started out 12 years ago, it was probably the point at which newspapers were really throwing their lot into the online game and giving everything away for free. And 10 years down the line, I think newspapers have realised that actually they probably did what the music industry did and sold the family silver and are having to pull back from that and really struggling to build a business model retrospectively. Now, I suspect that universities are being a little bit cleverer than that. I certainly hope so. But I wonder why you see the sort of MOOCs and the wider technological changes that we've been through over the last 18 months, taking universities as viable going concerns. And then perhaps after that, we can talk a bit more about the effect on academic staff and students and teaching and learning and so on.
Okay, well, first a disclaimer. I'm not sure there are any experts in this stuff. You know, it's happening around one, and you'd be very unwise to think you know what it's all about or predict where it's going. In my reading around this kind of stuff, I actually think there was something like MOOCs 20 years ago. But if you want to get something noticed, you have to have a snappy title. Mm. Don't you? So, you know, we're talking about MOOCs as a shorthand for something. And you know, if you unpick what that something is, what is it? It's access by somebody. So I would kind of step back a little bit and do sordid kind of economic jargon here. I mean, somebody's supplying something, somebody's demanding something, somebody's receiving something. So what is the kind of transactional basis? It's very interesting that all this stuff is going to... Let me say right up front, right? I forget when. Maybe 25 years ago, I was involved in something like this where somebody at the front was explaining why nobody would ever go to work in 20 years' time. Mm. We'd work from home. 15 years ago, I sat and I went, "This, the paperless office." So the avalanche, the disaster, the let's see. But go back to what is actually kind of happening. If you look at the Coursera and you look at the first 18 months of Coursera. And one of the things Coursera can do is a lot of analysis of who is logging in, why they're logging in, how long do they log in, when do they disappear, etc., etc. Right at the beginning of this process, 80% of those logging into a course, a MOOC via Coursera, already had a first or even a second degree. So let's pause for a second. What was the audience for this? The audience for it were either motivated professionally, or they were motivated as hobby learners, or whatever. So I think one of the things I'd like to bear in mind in this whole conversation is, who are the consumers, who are the audience, who wants what out of all this?
Have you done a MOOC?
I've done a MOOC. No, I've tried to log into one. I before I die, I really want to understand particle physics. But it's not going to happen. That kind of, I've got members of the Board of Trustees logging into these things, feeding back and all the rest of it. But just go back to the point. Who is doing what and why in this space? So you go from the beginnings of this stuff where, if I don't know what you would call them, either professional updaters or hobby learners, right? But last year, Georgia Tech has now created a whole MSc, I think in some area of computer science, or engineering, I don't remember exactly what, undercutting the price in the American market by 3 or 4 times. And I think they have 10 or 12,000 students signed up. So you've got the whole spectrum from, if you like, the hobby learner to some institutions seeing this as a holistic kind of delivery. Mm. And the other thing I think we should debate a bit is individual modules or individual celebrity lectures. Okay, the technology for that transmission and the excitement and the access, you know, millions of people can watch Steven Pinker or Stephen Hawking or whatever. But what are they getting? I mean, they're getting something that's a bit akin to watching an hour on the Discovery Channel. Okay, if they're not just hobby watchers, you can interact, and if there's lots of you doing it, you can talk to each other. But, you know, that is a very far cry from the Georgia Tech sudden development, which is to put together a whole host of this stuff that's accessed in that way, with learners who you know, can develop different styles of interaction. I guess people want to talk about this, you know, self-assessments and chat rooms and modern kind of social media interacting with academic stuff. But the distinction between the individual unit or hours fun or whatever and what we have traditionally called a degree, right, which we could debate, what does it mean? Why are people still seeking degrees? There's some kind of, you know, rubber stamp from some kind of establishment that says you have acquired a certain body of knowledge and you are equipped to do certain things. Well, you know, we could debate that. But what does it mean to have a degree? Why do people want degrees? If they don't want degrees, that's a different thing than if they do. So in the particular case of the University of London, we've got 100 years of an outreach program which started in the UK. Once upon a time, there was only, you know, Oxford and Cambridge and London. And the Sheffields and Exeters and Nottinghams of this world actually grew out of centres that did London external degrees. So once upon a time, there was Oxford and Cambridge and London external degrees and University College and King's. So that kind of business of providing access to a traditional high-standard degree continues around the world. We still have 54,000 students in 180 countries following that route. That is, separate from the technology, that's an incredibly different enterprise than setting up a unit in creative computing. And then it raises all sorts of questions about if people want that to be combined into something that replaces a traditional degree, who's in charge of that? Who actually says it's okay? Who regulates it? Who assesses it? Who puts the stamp on it?
I mean, it does to pick up on some of the points you raised. I mean, it seems to me that there has been a very piecemeal approach to courses that have gone onto some of these MOOC platforms. And actually, looking at the FutureLearn courses that were launched last week, they felt quite different, actually, from some of the earlier courses that were on Coursera and so on. I think initially, you seem to have these very high-profile professors at the very elite institutions doing it really as marketing and self-promotion on behalf of the individual professors as much as the institutions. I think I've had Vice Chancellor saying to me that actually they had people that had never shown the slightest bit of interest in teaching in their life, knocking on their door saying, I want my MOOC, which seemed to be, you know, the enthusiasm for a new form. But I think if you actually dig down into the details, some of the most popular or successful MOOCs that there have been the really specialist things, like equine nutrition is the one that's always quoted, isn't it? Because actually the people that sign up to do that really want to know about equine nutrition, so they see it through the course, and that's been very successful.
But that goes back to my point of in a sense the taxonomy of who's out there and wants it. What do they want? If you want those bite-sized professional updates, that's one world. But the apocalyptic stuff, this avalanche will replace universities as we know them. Well, universities as we know them deliver degrees. And that is a very different proposition from a module on equine nutrition.
So is the outcome of all this potentially that actually what MOOCs have proven is that there's huge appetite for this form of learning? There's lots of possibilities there. Do you think there might, when the fog clears and it settles down a year or two down the line, that actually this form of e-learning will be much more embedded in within traditional university models, so degrees will still be delivered in much the same way. I think of this makes me think of the University of Adelaide. Warren Bebbington, who's the Vice-Chancellor there, wrote a piece for THE a few months ago. They've had this extraordinary expansion in Australia where there was sort of a cap, the student numbers cap was completely lifted, take whoever you like, and there's been all sorts of concerns about quality, partly because you've ended up with absolutely enormous cohorts of students and lectures with sort of 1,000 people. And what Warren Bebbington doing is saying, actually, I'm going to ask all my staff to withdraw from delivering their courses in the normal sort of lecture and seminar format, do some very specific online resource educational resources along the lines of MOOCs, just typical OERs, and then do spend their actual time in the classroom doing small group teaching. But he said he's had quite a lot of pushback from academic staff because, well, it wasn't the job they signed up for to sort of deliver video-based modules like that. I mean, do you think that's an issue for universities too? Will academic staff across the piece be willing and able to adapt to something as dramatically different as that, if that's where we're going?
Okay, well, let's keep backtracking about the kind of issues, because the avalanche apocalyptic thing is that this will destroy traditional universities as we know them. Part of the interest from some of the original developers of Coursera was actually as an adjunct and a transformative disruption to the work in the conventional university, not to destroy the university, but in shorthand terms, what on earth is the point of somebody standing up in front of the audience here and delivering a lecture? You watch the lecture on the MOOC and then come along and we'll talk about it. So that was one of the original kind of intentions. So I think we should distinguish that, which is really quite interesting to debate, about the enhancement of things within a community, within a traditional structure, delivering a traditional degree, from the wilder shores of this will take over conventional universities, nobody will ever build a lecture hall again, and so on and so forth. But yet you then have to put that, I think, it's interesting, you know, from the introverted university learning point of view, but there's a real economic world out there. Student debt in the United States, I believe, is now higher than general credit card debt. Right? The sustainability of mass education systems simply in financial terms, it seems to me hugely unlikely that those who drive public and other funding will not see this as a way of delivering the same at much lower cost. And whether that's then delivered within a conventional university and somebody will break ranks and sell the pass, as it were, or the nobler ideas at Stanford were that this would fantastically enhance things for conventional students at conventional Stanford by getting double their money's worth, because instead of just standing listening to the lecture, they get that. And then they'd come along, they get the lecturer again to talk to. So I think it's a very different kind of concept. And the point you raised, and see if heads nod in the audience again, that totally changes the job description and the skill sets that you require of people in the university. You know, the most charismatic lecturer standing up in front of the room, but they could agree to be videoed maybe, but you know, the hordes of people who are going to produce the fabulous interactive videos, that the upfront investment for that is enormous. Mm. What's there sunk in Coursera already? $90 million? $100 million?
And the other thing, I mean, I'd like to talk a little bit about FutureLearn, just because it's fresh and it's just launched, and there's been an awful lot of store put in it, I suppose. I mean, one of the things you said earlier about MOOCs having been around, you know, 20 years ago and in slightly different format. I mean, the UK has kind of led on some of these distance learning in lots of ways, haven't they? Through the OU and I suppose international programmes too. And it just seems with MOOCs that it's one of those slightly galling things that America suddenly took an interest, venture capital put a bunch of money behind it. Suddenly it was kind of, you know, New York Times said 2012 was the year of the MOOC, and suddenly there's all this enthusiasm. Are we actually, have we somehow lost handed over something that we were kind of world leading in to the Americans.
Who's the we? Pat said earlier, Goldsmith's very famous because there are fabulous individuals who create things. Coursera came out of two or three individuals at Stanford.
Mm.
It wasn't America, it wasn't the president, it wasn't the state, it wasn't the governor. It's the two individuals in the university. So maybe it's part of that wider thing that we always mourn is a different attitude to being entrepreneurial and different access to venture capital.
Mm. But David Willetts is very worried about this. I mean, he feels MOOCs and the MOOC platforms that are out there are kind of an American asset.
Yeah.
He understands has leaned very heavily on the OU to get them to launch FutureLearn, and that's, you know, you'll know from your days in the department how these things operate.
And if you were a minister, you'd go around doing that, and you'd stalk the corridors saying to people like me 10 times a day, why did we never spawn a Google? And you point out some arithmetic facts about sizes of markets and all sorts of things, and it doesn't really kind of go away. But yeah, well, in this particular domain, Coursera took off in a particular place. I think what's interesting to debate is MIT and Harvard, a different enterprise, but grabbed it and are really interested.
Mm.
The two institutions in the UK who resolutely have set their face against being involved in this so far are Oxford and Cambridge.
Mm. Mm. And what's the reason for that? That they want to
preserve I'm running neither of those institutions, so I don't know. But I would make the following argument, but then you'd say, well, you could make that about MIT and Harvard. I mean, one of these things is about widening access, getting one's stuff out there to a bigger population, increasing the market, etc., etc. Oxford and Cambridge are basically branded positional goods. So the last thing in the world you want is more people to have access to them because you destroy the brand. Is this being recorded?
I'll move on. 3 or 4 times, yeah. The access points are very interesting.
I'm conjecturing here that this might be a little...
obviously the whole point about a MOOC is that it's massive and international and you can...
And it's open.
And open. So you can have people, you know, the idea is that you have people in a kind of Indian slum suddenly have access to these wonderful lecturers and that's great. But a lot of these MOOCs, when you actually look at them, require a fairly significant amount of education before you can do anything meaningful with them, I would have thought. And also, there's the access to technology issue, really. I mean, if you look at... We did a piece on the way that mobile phones are supposedly going to revolutionise education in Africa. And actually, access to the internet in Africa is at about 15% penetration. In the UK, it's about 87%. But even within that, I mean, Africa, there's huge... You know, Somalia had something like 1.2% access to internet. And even then, it's probably not broadband. And the individuals who have access to it won't have the latest smartphone that we all have in our pocket to sort of follow these MOOC things. So are we getting slightly overexcited about the, that this is going to be a great leveller for the world?
Well, I think some people are. I'm sceptical and cynical. I'm not overexcited. No, I think there's a lot of hype there. And you just look at the original Coursera stuff. This is basically the already educated finding yet more ways of accessing and interesting, stimulating knowledge. The potential is obviously enormous. Just a little plug for the University of London, you see, where you don't have exotic broadband in North Congo or whatever, you can still ship University of London study units out there. And so we've got students in 180 countries, and there can't be a very high percentage of those that have got big broadband coverage. So if we get swept up in this idea the future lies entirely in this kind of transmission and this kind of stuff, you know, Facebook and this is not a universal, universally accessible phenomenon. Mm. So I don't know, but I think calm the excitement, just stand back and just do a bit of taxonomy. Who is this for, and why would you supply, and who wants it?
Mm.
I tell you why the University of London put 5 courses up on Coursera about a year ago. It was basically, crudely, that we would see this initially as a fantastic marketing taster device. you get a taster of the sort of things you could do if you enrolled in the University of London. So we got 500,000 hits in 1 month.
And is there if we had
a 10% conversion rate, this is big bucks, you know.
Have you had a conversion rate? Is there any evidence that you can track that it's made the difference?
Commercial incompetence, dude. We've got competitors out there, you know.
Yeah. I'll just quote you from a report that was put out this week by the Observatory on Borderless Higher Education. I don't know how many in the audience are actually academics, but this sounded fairly terrifying to me if I was working in a university. They said that looking ahead to 2020, the traditional lecturer may soon be replaced by networks of online mentors working for several universities. Academic staff are likely to be employed part-time by several universities at a time, often working remotely via the internet rather than working for a single employer. I mean, that's fairly terrifying, isn't it?
It's not terrifying, it's nonsense. First of all, just go back and think, what are universities? They're very different kinds of universities, right? So all that stuff is predicated that universities are simply full of people who teach 24 hours a day, and that is the craft, as it were. So it's got nothing to do with scholarship, nothing to do with research. Part-time mentors, I'm sure, could be used for all sorts of things. But to actually, if a university does not have a body of researchers and scholars, it's a totally different kind of entity. So this separates a sort of rather transactional teaching thing from something more profound, I think. So my pitch is nonsense.
Should we... I don't know...
I'd like a few more people nodding.
One of the ideas today was to get some questions from you, the audience, as well. I don't know if anybody wants to jump in now. Anything that's come out of this or anything that we haven't touched on yet that you'd like to sling at either of us, but principally Adrian. There in the middle.
My name is David Van Gaal. I'm responsible for fundraising and alumni relations at Goldsmiths. The president of MIT, talking about MOOCs about a year ago, said that he thought MOOCs would not replace the campus-based experience, but take MIT's quality out to the wider world. So I just wanted to make that point. But I think looking at the audience for online courses, I think within the context of university, we've got prospective students and former students. And for prospective students, they can be a way to market the university, to engage them in pre-learning before they enroll. Mm. And for alumni, they can be a way to offer that community of intellectual investigation that, you know, study at university is supposed to be part of, but which in alumni relations we find so difficult to offer in any sort of meaningful way.
That's interesting. I mean, I've not heard that before, that this was actually being seen not just as a marketing tool to prospective students, but as a way to keep alumni on board and presumably get them to support you, put their hand in their pockets. I'm sure you wouldn't put it as crudely as that, but I know this is what vice-chancellors travel the world doing. I mean, is that something that you've...
No, I think that the taster intro thing really is quite interesting. But, I mean, in some sense, if there are noble ideas behind this about reaching those who've never been reached before, etc., etc., that's not in that space, is it? This is pure marketing competition to get more people to go to Goldsmiths and to Queen Mary. So let's be clear what these things are for. They, you know, commercial marketing tools, yes. As I say, keep going back to the fact that the Coursera was hitting 80-85% of those who were already educated in some sense. So I think there's an interesting question about whether this really does open up a channel for kind of reaching the dispossessed, as it were, you know, the cultural knowledges, the access to broadbands. I don't know what, you know, what's a starter course if really you're starting with a blank sheet? I don't know. But I mean, there's a million and one kind of uses, and although it might not be the most noble in the world, I think its marketing is vitally important. And as I say, that's what we did with our tasters, was just see how many people who maybe had never kind of heard of University of London external program, you know, 500,000 in a month.
I think that's quite visible on the course, on some of the courses that are on offer on Future Learn as well. I think Leicester, who, as we all know, have been flogging the dead horse of Richard III for some time. We've got, you know, England in the time of Richard III, and that's very clearly linked into kind of promoting Leicester as an institution. But then some of the others, they've got one on dental photography in practice, and it says that it would be of interest to anyone, and you think, really? I don't know where they're coming from. Sorry, another question at the back.
Do you know, I've suddenly got an interest in dental photography. Only 25% of the population does have access to the internet. But if we think of evolution in terms of the OU and technology, then surely there's got to be something quite interesting about how many people still have access to radio, and to actually these sorts of podcasts can, through different medium, be sent out to, if it is genuinely about opening access, then I think there's something very interesting around technology, speaking to technology and thinking about mediation in a different way. And then my other point that I think is perhaps the bit that might be relevant to, more relevant in a way to us here, is there seems to me often to be the issue of the physical aspects of our teaching, and in particular, I suppose, when we're actually watching somebody in the craft of design, art, drama, and being real time able to observe that. And it seems that that is something that, in terms of online courses, we haven't cracked yet, is how do we make that a group experience or a reflective experience, and what opportunities are there in terms of reflecting on our practice, our tradition of practice, that technology can perhaps help us reflect on and grow from, rather than seeing it as a marketing tool or a communication tool. So rather than broadcasting, how do we make it truly interactive?
It does seem to me slightly as though the grand, you know, great aims of the public good and so on have fallen by the wayside quite quickly, haven't they, with all the talk turning to marketing really rather quickly. The other thing I'd be interested to hear, referring to radio and so on, this isn't, we shouldn't perhaps put all our eggs in the MOOCs basket. There are other ways that that universities can exploit new technologies and so on. Is MOOCs kind of the only game in town as far as vice chancellors are concerned when they're thinking about technology, or are there other things that are, you think?
Let me just give you one example from my own kind of little world of maths research. If you talk about tradition, you know, if you were back in school and you did your homework and the teacher discovered that you'd written the same mistake as the guy next to you on the desk, you'd be accused of cheating or collaborating or whatever. So part of a tradition was, this is all about being an individual. And then employers would say, this is terrible, nobody knows how to work in a team, and so on and so forth. But you'd have thought, well, at least maths research, that is the scope of brilliant individuals. They sit at a desk, you know, they just do this stuff. There's a guy called Tim Gowers, who's a British Fields medalist, and he and others have created this kind of cloud environment where you throw mathematics problems out there, and tens of thousands of people around the world contribute ideas to this thing. I mean, there's an example of technology and, if you like, a sort of Facebook writ large, attacking research problems. So I think, don't get totally hooked up on the thing. Going back to Lady Back, access, I mean, if there were another 1,000 people who, God help them, wanted to hear us tonight but couldn't make it, you know, that's one form of access they could have. But access in that other sense of reaching those who are dispossessed, who don't have, which I would say historically is what the University of London External Programme did. It gave people like Nelson Mandela in his cell on Robben Island the opportunity to do a law degree, etc. I think we keep needing to come back to this taxonomy of who you're doing it for, why you're doing it, who's going to do it, who's going to fund it, et cetera, et cetera. Because there are a myriad of fabulous things to do with it. And it'd be fabulous if there were 1,000 people who just couldn't come tonight who could listen in. That's great. It's like listening to a radio program or catching up afterwards on the rewind button on the telly or something, which I don't know how to use. But the people in my house who can actually see stuff that was on last week. I've never kind of figured out how to do it. So these are all aspects of widening access in various kinds. But this, again, this avalanche type thing, the world as we know it is over, I just don't buy in any shape or form.
Okay, so I get a question here and then...
Yeah, just to respond to that immediate point, is for me, I mean, one of the... I'm responsible partly for the iTunes thing here and have a bee in my bonnet about the gossip press and spend the rest of my time in media comms worrying about the question of technology in relationship to the academy, in relationship to politics and so on. And I think that part of what happens, and I work on Create, I don't know if you know the Hargreaves project, the Arts UK project, on digital publishing. And one of the things I'm finding there is just, you know, a complete, I don't know, mental block about the question of technology, where I think academics can be really helpful, you know, to these kind of broader cultural industry debates in publishing and so on. And it's not just kind of Tolkien's conception about the extent of technological agency. We know, but we've been thinking, you know, philosophers are useful, right? I mean, they've been telling us for some few hundred years that it actually is never just a question of technology, so we have to look at technology complex relationships with ongoing social and political and economic factors. And actually, I think more than a misconception, I think it's very expedient when you put all of the emphasis on the technology is going to be changing publishing or academia is going to get rid of academics. Is that you know, by claiming a revolution, nothing changes.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens if you're going to be thrown over the side of the boat, you're just going to cling on like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, keep things exactly as they are for as long as you possibly can. So there's a real danger, I think, with the hype, if we want to call it simply hype, is that the things that we do want to look at, the structural changes, issues around pedagogy, issues around publishing and opening out goes back academic publishing gets shut down almost straight away in this narrative arc that just keeps on coming in every context. And actually, MOOCs are not everything, but in the context of MOOCs, there's been a feminist initiative, I don't know if you've heard of it, called FemTechNet. And FemTechNet is a feminist critique of a MOOC. By feminists are... I could go into that a little bit, but it's partly about models of pedagogy, you know, the sage on the stage, the top-down model, looking more closely at collaborations and what have you. So that's kind of happening. It's by no means perfect. It's got its own problems. It is exporting still feminist American scholars to the world, but it's working on it. And one of the advantages it has, I think, is that it doesn't have such a grass view of technology.
I suppose that's inevitably a problem when journalists get interested in anything. Suddenly it will be reduced down to a sort of this is, you know, the avalanche stuff.
But, if you get back to the heart and soul of universities and learning and stuff, I mean, just take what's possible in terms of visualisation because of technology. And you take mathematical concepts, and of course you can't see in four dimensions, but boy, actually you can if you rotate it in various ways. When I was a lad, incomprehensible, you know, you couldn't do it. So this hang up on the MOOC thing, I think, is distorting a more interesting conversation. But the thing, going back to some of the points about, you know, enhancing learning, some of the interesting stuff you can do through the MOOCs and Coursera are doing, because they've now invested in a lot of analytic capacity, and you know that you can slow down, you can play it at different speeds. And one of the other experiments is that for 50% of the learners, there's a subliminal face of the lecturer in the right-hand corner that you don't see. And then they track whether more people stayed with the module in the one where the face was flashing and so on, and do males and females slow it down at different rates and so on and so forth. All of which is kind of interesting, really, because it could really enhance learning and teaching.
Mm. Question back here.
Michael Young, Pro Warden for Students and Learning here at Goldsmiths. I'm interested in the comment earlier about how to measure the quality, a potential user might measure the quality of a MOOC, and also what maybe the unintended consequences if MOOCs are successful, future learning, etc., are successful. Unintended consequences in terms of potential university students' decisions about where to learn and how to learn. If I was interested in FY nutrition, I might look for the MIT MOOC, but I might equally look for the MOOC which has the most enrolments in the completion statistics, which is more of a kind of social media way of thinking about it. And I might equally have expectations about the way a course is taught and delivered that may or may not accord with a degree program that I would be very expensive.
Yeah.
And I think if universities are going to commit to MOOCs, then we have to think through the potential ramifications if that venture succeeds.
But why focus that particular kind of question on MOOCs? It's out there more general, isn't it? I mean, you've got different institutions marketing, let's say, their law degrees. Come to us. We've got an 80% pass rate.
Is there any evidence that students are doing anything other than just sort of leafing through Coursera's books and picking the ones that happen? It's a bit like going to a sweet shop, but it's all free. And sort of, oh, I'll have that, and I'll have that, and I'll have that, and you know, do 50% of that one. You don't bother with that one at all, and you finish that one. Has there been much? I don't actually know the answer to this, but has there been much work looking at how choices are made?
No, I don't think so. I mean, nor is there actually, in my view, a body of knowledge about how students choose conventional universities.
Yeah, one thing you can't do. Yeah.
No, but you know, Dave Willips, great man, but you know, there's this assumption that markets are basically fine and all that's wrong is there isn't enough information. So all these key information sets that universities are going to produce, the model is that somebody's going to sit in front of a computer and compare all these key information sets and employability rates and all the rest of it. Whereas they're going to decide whether they want to be in a town or a campus, where are their mates going. You know, I mean, there are human behavioural kind of knowledges that one has that go slightly beyond
these.
Sure,
that's true. I think that there's a fear behind my question is that the whole world of kits, the consumerism that can apply, might be actually reinforced by MOOCs.
Yeah, I'm sure it will be.
I'm going to take a couple more questions, but I'm being told that this we'd go on much longer. This podcast will be so long, no one will listen to it. So just take one at the front here, and then perhaps one at the back, and we'll
pass it. It's probably just me, but the most interesting parts of my lectures are actually the students and their contribution. And it's different every lecture and every year, even if I may have given the same lecture last year or something similar. But two points of that. One is the actual content is changing every 6 months, every 3 months, whatever, and it's out of date, so very fast. So I think there's a danger with fixing in certain ways with certain technologies that an awful lot of people are going to be looking at out-of-date stuff, firstly. And secondly, the actual interaction with the students is, and their comments, their disagreement, is at the heart of that learning. And unless the camera's backwards onto the students rather than onto the lecturer, you're going to miss a major part of that learning.
But you see, the counter that some would make would be, you think the great bits are when you're interacting with the students. If you gave them the straight spiel stuff as a MOOC first, you'd have the whole hour to interact with them.
Yeah, that's possible, but at the same time, it's not, again, it's this fixed thing, which is, it's not a question of giving a spiel and then having a discussion. Students interrupt throughout and make the whole thing a dialogue, and it changes every time you do it. And I think the more we've got very international students and you're getting those different cultures interacting with that, it's a very live thing. And I would hate that. Well, I would assume it to be out of date within a month, couple of months after happening.
I think I'd take the point about it getting out of date very quickly. The question of interaction, there is, of course, it may not be much good to you as a lecturer, but there is evidence that students are forming groups outside. You know, in Delhi, I think there were, you know, dozens of groups of people who are all doing the same MOOC, and they get together in cafes and you know, probably have the conversations that you are having in a lecture theatre. But so, just take one more question. Who wants the last? Top left.
Universities. Do you think that we might encounter a situation where the elite universities, who aren't necessarily looking so much at the revenue potential of something like a MOOC, can fully understand it as a sort of form of soft power, a form of kind of, you know, global reach for them, you know, a kind of brand penetration for them, and they're dealing with MOOCs in an entirely different way to perhaps other institutions that are, you know, perhaps ignorantly seeing this as a revenue stream, a kind of scramble to add another string to the bow?
Well, they might not be ignorantly seeing it. That might be the salvation. So I think there will be a huge variety of business models and ways in which you'd use it. What's interesting at the moment, and not quite explicable, is that the elite institutions in the States are seeming to embrace it at a faster rate than the so-called elite institutions in the UK.
I think if you take, most Web 2.0 technologies, social media technologies, one of the recurring points is that they actually don't translate into, regular forms of revenue in the long term. People very often struggle to establish a kind of income from an Instagram.
The big... people describe it in different ways, how to monetize a MOOC, or more vulgarly, turning MOOCs into moolah.
but if you think purely in terms of the metadata that a Stanford is going to get, for instance, from the vast numbers of people coming into their computer science program, that has a market value. That metadata alone and the ad revenue that they might attract alone. You're Herefordshire Polytechnic or whatever that runs this small thing that might get 1,000 people. Trying to find out how to do screen printing has no, kind of product in metadata terms or in advertising terms.
Is it even? I don't know. It's even clear who if there is ever a business model that is worked out that is profitable. Who's going to profit if the dominant MOOC platforms like Coursera and so on do kind of corner the market in the way that Amazon and eBay have? Is there a risk that universities will have done a deal with a?
Well, there are contractual profit sharing ways of doing that. So already you can pay to get a piece of paper that says that you completed the MOOC. Mm. You can pay extra to get it assessed and have a piece of paper. And in the States, there is this organisation whose name I keep forgetting, but it's some crediting kind of thing, which may pick up just bank credits as you go along, which are transferable. So I think there are obvious ways in which it's already being monetized.
Fine. Okay, and just a final thought from you on the University of London's position on this. You've had 5 MOOCs on Coursera. Are you going to put any more on there? Will we see you on FutureLearn anytime soon, or will you stick with the American giant? And
oh dear, we've run out of time.
On that note, thank you very much for being here, and I think we're going to go for a glass of wine.
Great. Join the audience.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.